Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Thursday, February 4th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. We have a very packed and interesting agenda today, and we are going to start off with an informational meeting update on the implementation of Oregon Motor Voter. So we have, I think, a panel of presenters that I'm going to call forward, including our Secretary of State, Jean Atkins. Kathy Marston and Jim Williams are joining her, if the three of you would like to come forward. And members, you'll remember that we just had a very, very brief update on this at our interim committee hearing, but this will be a more comprehensive update, and I think you have a packet of materials in front of you in a nice blue folder. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Chair Rosenbaum, and members. Thank you for the opportunity. I am Jean Atkins, Secretary of State. I thank you for the opportunity to present again on the implementation of Oregon Motor Voter. As I promised you 2 to 3 weeks ago, we're now prepared to give you some additional information and actual data about what has transpired since the program started up on January 1st. In my last appearance, I thanked a lot of people. I promise not to run through that list a second time, but I still commend to you the key public and private partners that made this program a reality. They joined us in what was a very public process where the concerns of opponents and excitement of supporters alike were heard, and I think it's a better program for having done that. Today I have with me Elections Director Jim Williams and Jefferson County Clerk Kathy Marston. They have a few things to say when I'm done, and I want you to have the opportunity to check in and ask any questions that I don't answer here. So you do have in your packet, in your materials, a full set of the public communication documents that have been developed for Oregon Motor Voter. You have a brochure that is something that is given to anyone who comes to the Department of Motor Vehicles and has a transaction that includes an issuance of a license or ID. You have the rule manual, so you know how the counties and the state is running the program. And you have the elements that are included in the mailing that goes out to individuals. It goes only to those who have had a license, permit, or ID card issued by the Motor Vehicles Division, who are eligible by age, citizenship, and residence address to vote in Oregon, but who are not currently registered to vote. There's a cover letter, you'll see, instructions and a card tear-off to be returned if there's information they want to provide us, and outside and inside envelopes so you can see what it looks like an election mailing, and a business reply envelope so that if they do the tear-off and return that a card to us, they're able to do that in a secure envelope. That's one of the things that really came out of our public hearings around this, and I very much appreciate the feedback that took us to that. We spent some extra attention to the education about the ways that addresses can be kept confidential, and you'll see that in the educational material. I want to acknowledge Sybil Hebb from Oregon Legal Services and folks that work alongside her who were very helpful to us in developing these materials and giving us feedback about how folks who perhaps are at risk but still have the right to vote and want to exercise that right can do so in a safe way. So far, we haven't had a lot of feedback that that the materials are causing distress or confusion. We've had a grand total of something like 15 calls into our office, a few to counties as well, generally asking about their registration status because they're surprised to learn that their registration had lapsed or that because they moved and hadn't given us a new address, they were no longer registered. But at this point, and Knockwood, we have obviously are still going to be getting feedback as time goes along. We've had some relatively positive response. So the one thing that we have for you today that we didn't have for you before is the data sheet that you have added to your file. I don't have mine with me. Excuse me.
It's basically a pie chart, members, that has orange on it.
Thank you. Sorry. gave mine away in the process. So this is something that we did share with the press today. I want to explain to you about it. We're obviously tracking this closely day to day. Many more mailings have gone out than we can actually reach conclusions about, because people have 21 days to respond and return cards. That deadline has only passed for 6 days worth of mailings, but we do now have about a week's worth of data where the card was sent and 21 days has passed, and we can make some comparisons about and look at how people are responding. It's a very early sample and a small one. I've noticed over the 5 days we've been tracking, it does bounce around a bit, so we know that we're going to have to keep that in mind as we look at this early data. In the big picture, these numbers are not on the chart. The overall volume between January 1st, when the program started out, and February 2nd, there was almost 53,000 issuance transactions at the DMV. 72% of those people were found to be currently registered to vote. The remainder, slightly more than 15,000, have gotten mailings from the Secretary of State's office since January 5th when we began sending mailings. Our current daily average for OMV mailers is 753 going out each day. By the end of February 2nd, Tuesday, 6 days worth of mailings, 4,653, which you'll see on your chart here, had matured in our system. That is, the 21-day response deadline had been reached. So this is the group that we can begin to analyze in terms of how people are responding. For that cohort of 6 days of mailing, 742, or 16%, returned an OMV card to us. 305 of them opted out, and 437 of them made party choices. Again, this is an early sample. We'll be watching to see how these percentages hold up over time. But as you see, we have made pie charts to indicate 16% of those who received mailings did return the card. The ultimate result, and you'll find this number by taking the number of records that were that caused us to send a mailing and subtracting the number who added out, who opted out, and you will find that 4,348 new voter records have been sent to the counties for the final processing steps that they take. Let me put that into some context. Over the past 8 years, if you look at the voter registration data in our system, Oregon has added an average of 2,023 registered voters to the rolls each month. Under Oregon Motor Voter, we just doubled that average monthly registration number in just the first 6 business days of full implementation. So while we used to register just over 2,000 people a month under OMV, we've registered so far over 4,300 people in 6 business days. Also to date, and this is not something that we were projecting as carefully, and although we certainly were interested in it, it was part of the bill for us to use this opportunity to update addresses of registered voters, and we've processed over 17,000 address updates for currently registered voters. We're now able to anticipate that counties will see many fewer returned undeliverable ballots, and we can have more confidence that ballots that we send reach the voters before each election. We're working to develop reporting tables that can be added to our current monthly update that we do of the centralized voter registration database. We share this very early data with you and welcome your feedback. We're looking at the possibility of using this kind of a template to do our add-on, and if you say there are other numbers or other ways to present it that you think would be more useful or additionally useful, we're happy to take that input. We know that evaluation is very important, that other states are looking to us to provide information about how this works. We are pioneering. No one has done this before. But our message to date is our systems are up and working. The results show that more eligible Oregonians will have ballots in upcoming elections. We likely still have some things to learn, but we're pleased to be well on our way. Thank you. I think both Jim and Kathy have statements. I'm happy to take any questions, or we can wait until they're done, Madam Chair.
Why don't we hear from all of you, and then we'll open it up.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I've worked in elections for 24 years, and during that time, I've seen a lot of major historical election laws passed and implemented.
I'm sorry, Jim, could you just say your name for the record?
I'm sorry, Jim Williams, Elections Director for the Secretary of State. Over the 24 years I've been in elections, lots of laws have been passed and implemented. Oregon Motor Voter is another very historic and significant law that we're very excited about. The original Motor Voter Law was passed in 1993. Now, 22 years later, the Oregon Motor Voter Law is a very significant milestone. It expands voter registration and automates the voter registration process. Oregon is once again a national leader in elections, just as we were the first to make voting easier with vote by mail. We're now also making voter registration easier and more convenient for Oregonians. OMV puts ballots into the hands of many more eligible Oregonians and gives more people the opportunity to participate in democracy and share their voice. That's why, when we hear the numbers that Secretary Atkins just mentioned, we're very proud and excited about the success so far of this new implementation of the new law. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and committee members. For the record, my name is Kathy Marston, Jefferson County Clerk. I hope you can hear me. My voice doesn't carry very well, so. I would like to thank you on behalf of the Oregon County Clerks for your interest in the status of the Oregon Motor Voter Project. From a clerk's standpoint, the OMV project, Oregon Motor Voter, has been well received by my fellow clerks. Comments I have heard from fellow clerks have been very positive for the most part. There have been a few bugs, as is common with any software implementation, but the OMV team has been very responsive in researching and resolving these issues. Communication with the clerks regarding these issues between the OMV team and the clerks has been outstanding. The clerks are very appreciative of the collaborative effort between OACC and the Secretary of State's office in making this a successful venture. We don't know yet the full impact Oregon Motor Voter will have on our budgets, but we are very grateful for the financial assistance we have received to date. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you all three for your testimony and also for such an excellent visual packet. So I'll open it up for questions. I did want to ask you just one clarification, Madam Secretary, maybe for you or Jim, but it looks like 7% of the cards that are being returned are coming back after the deadline to return them. What happens to those?
The wishes that are expressed on those are honored. They will maybe done so slightly later than they would otherwise have been. Any opt-out is sent to the clerks, and if indeed they have already been moved into the registration system, that registration is canceled, and they are notified of that cancellation. If they make a party registration change, that is implemented as well.
Okay, did we have other questions? Yes, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have three or four questions. Mostly, Jim, they're technical questions. And I'm not giving you these in advance only because 11:30 I had this story told me. I don't think it's technically possible, but I'm going to ask the question. I listened to a story earlier this morning. A young college student went in, changed from their typical registration of, you know, I have the permit, now I want to be 21 and drink, something along that line, right? And so they updated their registration, and of course they automatically got registered to vote at the DMV. They didn't do anything, according to them, and this is secondhand. So as you know, 95% of all first stories aren't exactly accurate, okay? And then they got a voter registration card, that, as this says right here, along with the letter of, you know, what do you want to do next? And the voter registration card was for a party registration before they'd ever got the card to opt for a party. Can you actually opt for a party at the DMV?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, all of the traditional methods of registering are still in effect, so there are still some paper forms, as well as the brochure the Secretary mentioned, of course, has a form on it. I would need to get more information to determine exactly what happened in that case. And if we have other technical questions, luckily we do have some backups in the room, too.
For the record, I'll follow up just because it doesn't sound like it's technically. It's not like a form. It's like they went to the DMV, and, of course, again, you know, he said, she said, when we were all kids, we did that in the high school or in the elementary school, and we know what happened. It's like it didn't work out that way. But I have a follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
And there's a really not technical or not necessarily technical, but the related questions. Once you register to vote, which is, I suppose, good, we have 4,000 people. We have 4,653, but, of course, we only have 472 that replied, and 40% of those said no thank you. But my question is taking this group of 4,600 people, and they're registered now, to become an inactive voter means you only have to miss like two elections. Last time I checked, I'm looking for the county clerk. And so if they don't vote in November, these 4,000 people don't vote in November, and they don't vote in the next primary, when do they become an inactive registered voter and they no longer get a ballot? I think the clerk probably knows. This is historical.
We're also listening. She knows better than we do.
Madam Chair and Senator Boquist, if a voter does not participate in two general elections, so it would be in 2016 general election and the 2018 general election, theoretically 5 years has passed, and their registration would be canceled. They'd be notified, and their registration would be canceled if we had not received any updates, if there was no activity on their registration record.
So follow up.
We can get you the statutes. I think it's presidential, not just general, so that there's the 4 years
correct.
In between.
Yes.
So 16 to 18 would be 16 to 20.
That's what I'm looking for. How long before these people drop off the rolls?
Five years.
And then I guess the second question is that I heard you think, which is a positive portion of motor voter, even though I voted against it, is that when you update, you're actually checking addresses too. So if you have a situation in which I go, my address changes from what's on the voter registration card at year two, for example, and I haven't voted for 2 years, what action is being taken then? You're reissuing a new voter registration card for the new address and sending it to that address and canceling the old address?
Yes, I'm trying to make sure that I'm following exactly what you're saying. When we do the match, the transaction has taken place at DMV, and at the state level we do the match, and we find that there is a newer address on the record for DMV than there is for the voter currently in the record. That new address is forwarded to the county so that they can contact the voter at the new address and confirm and get that updated address into their voter registration.
One final question.
Yes, go ahead.
Since we're going to hear this topic here later, I'm just curious if we thought and how we're going to deal with college students. And I really raise that question from this perspective. The college student is Jim's son or daughter is at home, and that's their DMV address, but then they go to college and they register at the college address, but the DMV address is different than the college address. And given the fact of, you know, general elections, and everybody knows what happens, at least the elected officials here know what happens there. How does that work? Is there a fail-safe system where they can, if the college student wants to get their ballot at school versus they want to get their ballot at home, even though the address is different?
They are establishing a residence address at the time that they register to vote and have to choose that registered address to be their registration address for voting. They could, of course, be out of state and still keep their home address, or they could move their registration address to the new place.
Okay. But that's a problem. You just pointed out a problem here, because if they go to DMV to update their driver's license to their parents' house, which they all do mostly, they bring laundry and food and everything else. They come. I mean, now you're having these competing addresses. If once you go to DMV, DMV is automatically going to re-register that college student to whatever that home address is they're using. You follow my.
And then their voter registration would be updated to that address that they have taken to the DMV under the system as it's now working.
Right.
We can look and see.
Mailing address and a residence.
And
address.
Right. I think that's a great question, Senator Boqvist. I think that probably is not that different from what happens right now, because my experience of students registering to vote is they usually register at their parents' address, because you have to have a residence in Oregon to be eligible to vote in Oregon. And then if they go to college out of state, they don't usually do anything. So they're receiving their ballot at their parents' address. And I don't know, I mean, I guess there is a process if you're residing out of state to have your ballot sent there. But in my experience, a lot of students don't remember to invoke that process. They probably don't change their driver's license to an out-of-state driver's license either. So.
Yeah, it has been an issue all along. I think the opportunity to update to where they are, where their driver's license is greater under the system now, but it's not necessarily different than it has been. But we will we'll put heads together in the experts of clerks and talk up and get you some good information back about exactly what is likely to take place.
Not just disagreeing, Madam Chair, but I am, because my experience since I've represented a college district before, not now, thank goodness. But having said that, is they go door to door with voter registration cards all the way through the dorms, and then people re-register. My concern is if whoever's doing that, if you re-register suddenly at the college in the fall voter registration, it happens every campus. I'm sure there's students around here somewhere, because we'll talk about this. They go door to door and they re-register that. If they register that card and it's now different from their DMV card that they just got 3 months before, but deconflicting that is the concern, so that the actual student gets to vote the ballot where they want to be. That's just my point.
There are a number of ways that addresses change, and making sure that we have the best address for the voter and that it is their residence address is something that we have to continue to pay attention to.
Additional questions? So I just was going to ask one more about the signature verification process and whether this new system is changing that at all. I see that when you return the motor voter card, you have to sign it, but of course, I assume the signature on file is that electronic signature that they take from you when your driver's license is issued or renewed. That becomes the signature on file? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you've answered all of our questions, and we will stay tuned as this moves forward, because I'm sure it's going to develop in fascinating ways that we're anticipating today and some we probably haven't anticipated. So
absolutely.
Thanks for doing such a
thanks
great job.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And thank you, Kathy, for being, I guess we were lucky that the county clerks are meeting this week in Salem, but thank you for being here too. Okay, so that completes our, we have another panel. Okay, so I'll call our next panel, and that is Lamar Wise, Brittany McPherson, and Nikki Fisher. The three of you would like to come forward.
Six kids that went to college. They're still a problem.
Hi, welcome to the Senate Rules Committee, and whoever wants to go first, just go ahead.
Sure. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I submitted testimony. I just wanted to say on behalf, my name is Nikki Fisher, the executive director of the Bus Project. On behalf of the Bus Project and other nonpartisan voter organizations, we just wanted to thank the Secretary of State and the folks who came in earlier, just to say thank you so much. We're really excited and celebrating this historic occasion today in the Capitol. So thank you so much for having us. We just wanted to, again, reiterate how excited we are. And, again, we submitted testimony for the record. So thank you.
Great. Thank you for being here.
Yes, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Ferrioli, and members of the committee. My name is Lamar Wise. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. The Oregon Student Association is a statewide student-led advocacy organization, which was established in 1975 to represent, serve, and protect collective interests of students in post-secondary education in Oregon. And on behalf of OSA, I'm here to thank the Secretary of State and the Department of Motor Vehicles and various allied organizations for their tireless efforts to advance voter registration systems throughout Oregon through Oregon Motor Voter. Earlier this morning, and just now, Secretary Atkins gave an overview of the incredible work that's been accomplished in just 1 month of our state's newest voter registration effort. The Oregon Student Association spends thousands of hours every year registering people to vote on campuses across Oregon. And we will definitely continue to do that. No worries. we have the deeply rooted belief that every eligible Oregonian should have access to their fundamental right to vote. And we're proud to be back here today to thank the legislature for continuing to make positive changes in Oregon, which is Oregon Motor Voter. As you know, students are definitely a very transient population, so we appreciate any efforts to make registration as simple as possible and as easy as possible and accessible. And thank you.
Great. Thank you for your testimony.
Chair Rosenbaum, members, my name is Brittany McPherson. I am a volunteer with the Bus Project, and I'm a student at Oregon State University. I'm just here today because I've worked to register young people and students to vote for 7 years of my life, which is a big chunk of my life. And I'm just here to commend the Secretary of State's office and the DMV and their work with all these great organizations through the legislative and rulemaking and implementation process to make Motor Voter a success. Like Secretary Atkins told you and like Lamar pointed out, Oregon Motor Voter has been a seamless transition in 2016 to streamline our voter registration in a secure manner. As a Master's of Public Policy student myself, who's actually studying election law and hopes to write her thesis on Oregon Motor Voter, I'm keenly aware of the progress that Oregon's made to make Motor Voter a secure and accurate process. It continues to make our legacy in making democracy more accessible by working thoughtfully to get the ballot into the hands of every eligible Oregonian through a system that we already interact with. Oregon Motor Voter will protect the fundamental right of every Oregonian, regardless of party, to have their vote counted. And it will ensure that those who encounter barriers to voting, like students, communities of color, veterans, active military, senior citizens, and people with disabilities, are able to fully participate in our democracy and vote.
Okay, well, thank you all three for your testimony and for your work on making this program successful as it moves forward. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I have a suggestion for a topic of your thesis.
Bring it.
in action, I'm using this opportunity so that the Secretary of State and Jim behind you will perk up at the same time here. But I think the success or failure of this program, I think, if from an academic point of view, is going to be, we'll just say, the first step will be November 16. And that is because, and the part of the thesis is that by that time we'll know how many tens of thousands registered. We'll also should be able, and I'm hoping the Secretary of State can tell you, of those 50,000, we're 10 months, we're a little less than 10 months out, of those 40,000 that registered, or 46,000 if we're on track to the same thing, that registered, how many of them actually vote? I mean, we sent them a ballot, now they get to participate. Because from an academic point of view, when you look at the number of respondents, it's only 700. And for whatever odd reason, and this is a question for any of you, because your younger generation's got to figure this out because we're all over the hill, is why did those 305 people opt out? They got a voter registration card and they just opted out and said, no, we don't want to participate. And I think that's one thing that needs to be looked at and studied from an academic point of view, since you're writing a thesis. And then the second thing is how many of those people are actually do turn out and vote and do participate in the system. We gave them the opportunity, and we're gambling all of our money that they're going to do it, but the question is whether they're going to do it.
Yeah, I hope I can answer that next year.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Boqvist. And I don't see any other questions, so thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
And that completes our informational hearing. So I will conclude the informational hearing. And we have a couple of bills to hear today. And I don't, Senator Devlin's not with us
not yet.
So we'll take them in order. So I'll start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1501. And Erin, would you tell us about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1501 corrects statutory reference to insurability of minor political parties to maintain status for 2016 general election based on number of registered electors as of July 1, 2015. This measure does have an emergency clause. This measure comes to you with no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And I will call our first panel, Robert Taylor and Brenda Bays. And then just to mention, members, that this bill might look a little bit familiar because this particular provision was in an omnibus elections bill, but it might have been not obvious that it was in there. I think it's the same language that we had in a bill that didn't make it all the way through the process in 2015. And we do have Dan Gilbert from Legislative Council here in the room in case there's any drafting questions. Okay, thank you, and welcome to Senate Rules. Please go ahead.
For the record, my name is Robert Taylor, the Deputy Secretary of State. We're here to hopefully accomplish something that we tried to do and failed to do in 2015, which is to fix a typo in a bill. The typo, as you can see from Senate Bill 1501, the original bill referred to subsection 4B of ORS 248.008, and instead of referencing 4B, it should have referenced 4A. So we need to change the B to an A, and that will correct the typo. The difference between Section 4A and 4B in that statute has to do with there are two different calculations that a minor party can use in order to achieve minor party status. So those minor parties include the Progressive Party, Libertarian Party, Working Families Parties, Constitution Party, for example. So if one way to qualify as a minor party is under subsection 4A, and we have, if we can go to the, we have a little slide here. So under 4A, it's a straight calculation. It's 0.5% of total registered voters 90 days before a general election. So for example, in the 2014 election, that calculation is done in the summer of 2014. So you look at total registration as of the summer of 2014, and if you're a minor party that has 0.5% of that, then you'll be a minor party in the upcoming 2014 election. Then for this upcoming election, same thing would happen. You would do the calculation in the summer of 2016 and see if you still have 0.5% of the total voter registration. And then in the 2018 election, you look at the total registration in the summer of 2018 for the upcoming 2018 election. So under 4A, which is what we are trying to fix here, the typo, you do a calculation every election cycle in the months before the election to see if you meet this registration threshold. There was a concern that Motor Voter would go into effect in January of 2016. There would be a lot of new registrations immediately before the November 2016 election, and so that this calculation in the middle for the 2016 election would be affected by Motor Voter. So the fix that was in the Motor Voter Bill for that, and that was described in 2015, was we were going to push the pause button. And the pause button was meant to do the calculation for the 2016 election based on voter registrations as of July 2015. So you do the registration calculation before motor voter comes into effect based on those numbers. And that would keep all of those minor parties as minor parties through the 2016 election. And then when you get to 2018, you're back on the regular schedule and you go on from there. So that's how 4A works now and what the fix is supposed to do. So if you go and look at 4B, which is the next slide, the calculation under subsection 4B is different. Under 4B, it's a lower threshold. It's 0.1%, so it's a lower threshold. And it's also based on a different number. So it's 0.1% of votes cast for governor in the last election for which a governor was elected for a full term. So, and then there's some other criteria. So you have a lower threshold based on the gubernatorial turnout, plus you have to field a statewide candidate, and that candidate has to perform in a certain way, get a certain number. So for example, in the 2014 election, the calculation under 4B is based on turnout in the 2010 governor's race, since that was the most recent governor's race where a governor was elected for a four-year term. Then when you go to the 2016 election, there's the calculation for the 2016 election under 4B is based on turnout in the 2014 governor's race, because that was the most recent election for which a governor was elected to a full four-year term. Then in the 2018 election, the calculation under 4B is based also on the 2014 governor's turnout, because 2014 is still the last election for which a governor was elected for a full term. And it's only until the 2020 election that you would look back to the results of the 2018 gubernatorial election, because that's the next time a governor gets elected for a full four-year term. So we had to do a fix under 4A, because 4A was going to be based on some registration numbers that were happening in 2016 right after the advent of motor voter. So we had to fix that, because parties who were going to use 4A to get their minor party status would be immediately impacted if we didn't do a fix. We did not have to do any sort of a fix under 4B, because all of the calculations that are happening under 4B are for 2016 and 2018 are based on numbers that are already in the books for 2014. So the parties that are using 4B to maintain minor party status are not in jeopardy of anything bad happening to them in the 2016 election as a result of motor voter. But for the parties that are using 4A, they are in jeopardy. They are in jeopardy. And if we don't fix this for them right now, they would be adversely impacted potentially in the 2016 election. So that's why we just humbly, forcefully ask you to please help us fix this typo. That's all. Thank you.
And Brenda, did you have anything to add, or are we just here to answer questions?
Madam Chair, I'm just here to answer questions.
Great. So just to recap, there still are two methods of qualifying as a minor party. The second method that you described, which is the paren B, is not changed by this bill. I think there's been some written testimony that seems to think that we deleted that method, but just because that language doesn't appear in the bill, that language is still in the law, as you showed it on the slide, as it is in the statute. It's not changed at all.
That's correct. And as it is now, with the typo in place in existing law, it actually makes a nonsensical change to 4B, is the problem we have.
It's
now.
Basically using right. The language from A and labeling
right.
it as
right.
B.
Right? And in some of the written comments, there was a suggestion to the effect of, well, if you're going to make a change to help parties who use 4A to qualify, then you should also make a change to help the parties that use 4B to qualify. And that, on its surface, makes sense, except that if you're using 4B to qualify, you're already okay. Because for 4B, we're looking at the 2014 governor's race, and that number's already set.
Okay, thank you. Senator Boquist.
Okay, so, Council, you have to help me, or maybe Brenda can. 4A, if I read it correctly, is based on registration. That's correct, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And then 4B is based on participation, voter turnout.
That's correct.
And can, and yeah, there's opposition testimony, okay? So I'm just trying to figure this out. So in terms of can any of these minor parties, because there's three that say, obviously they're all over the place, but there are, can any of them pick one of those two courses of action? So let's say, just hypothetically, I have a testimony, and this is just hypothetical, from the Oregon Progressive Party. They could pick, frankly, whichever one is more advantageous to them in order to make qualification. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And I think that's the crux of it. Because now here's my second question, trying to figure out logically what we're doing. Go back to 4A, which is registration, and follow my logic here from the existing testimony from the Secretary of State. We just had motor voter, which is kick in, and we just had 4,653 so far. Good job, well done. See, I'm even saying that, Robert. Good job, well done, got that. And so that's registration. So that registration number is climbing, we know that. What we don't know is the human interaction and their reply in much detail, because what we do know is that only 437 people actually had a positive reply out of the 4,600 that I want to vote and I want to do it this way. We had 305, which is roughly 40%, just opt out and say, I'm not voting anyway, so don't send me anything. What we don't know at this point, which was my question earlier, is that come November when we have 46,000 people, we don't know how many of them are just going to say, I didn't want to vote to start with, I don't know why you did it. And so they just don't vote. And the problem with that is that registration number of them not voting is going to rise those registration numbers until, I think I heard correctly, until 2018, after the general election in 2018. And that's the question of why would we even use the registration piece, because we know that number is going up and people are getting registered. But we don't even know they're going to participate. We're hoping they are. Am I making you follow the logic I'm trying to figure out here? I mean, nobody in their right mind would use the registration piece, because these people are registered and they may never vote. We might get to 18 and half these people just fall off the rope to the inactive registration.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. You're right about that, and you're also right to point out this question of, with the advent of Oregon Motor Voter, and you're bringing on a lot of new voters, and you do not know whether they will vote in the next governor's race, right, in 2018. So you don't know whether turnout, as just in raw numbers, if right, the turnout in the 2018 governor's race could be pretty much the same as right, it is in the 2014 exactly, race. Or it could be more if right, these people turn out. And we don't know that. We don't know that yet. We won't know that until the election happens. But your question about why would a party choose to maintain minor party status under 4A as opposed to 4B. So the easy way that when I looked at the numbers to try to understand that, that the two minor parties that have the highest voter registration, the Libertarian Party and the Working Families Party, they qualify under 4A, because that's just a straight how many people are registered, mm-hmm, and do I have a half of a percent in my party. So The big minor parties can use 4A, and it's just a straight calculation, and they're in. It's the smaller minor parties, the Progressive and Constitution Party, for example, they would use the 4B, because the 0.1% of total votes cast in the governor's race, that's a smaller number that they have to be over the threshold of. So they would use 4B because they only have to have a smaller number registered. But then 4B has some other criteria where they have to field a statewide candidate and do some other things to demonstrate still an active party. So that's the difference between why parties might make that choice. And from our perspective, the legislature set up that two-track system. That was always there. And we recognized with Motor Voter in 2015 that bringing these new voters on could cause a problem for people using 4A, because there was going to be a calculation that happened in 2016. And we wanted to fix that. We didn't have to do anything for the minor parties under 4B, because their calculation was always keyed off of a different number that already happened in 2014.
Follow up question.
Go ahead.
And actually, it's more of a, I'm trying to get consensus here, okay? What would you say, in your mind, and I guess, what do you say? I mean, we do have, there's the three parties that think they might be affected negatively are the Oregon Progressive Party, or at least allegedly, somebody's saying that, Oregon Progressive or Constitutional Party, Pacific Green Party. I mean, what do we say to all of the parties who weren't able to participate? We've already said that. That's why we did Motor Voter. What do we say to them that, no, this isn't really going to hurt you? You're mistaken. You follow what I'm saying? How do we convince them that this is the right thing to do? If, in fact, what I think you're saying is that it is.
It's the right. This bill, if passed, it corrects this typo, and it preserves these two minor parties, the Libertarian Party, the Working Families Party, that are in immediate jeopardy in 2016. Right. The other minor parties that you mentioned are not in immediate jeopardy in 2016, because the calculation for them is based on 2014. Now, all those parties down the road in 2018 for Libertarian and Working Families, and then 2020 for the other smaller parties, they will have to grapple with how the formula works for them in those later elections. They will. And all we're trying to do right now is fix this typo to preserve the status quo for these two minor parties in 2016, so that no harm befalls them in 2016. And once we do that and hit that pause button, then we can come back in 2017, the 2018 session, once we've had more experience with Motor Voter and the registration. And if there has to be other fixes to this, we can do it then. But what we're trying to do now is really avoid harm to these two minor parties.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay, I get it, that portion. But here's my question. We can't bind a future legislature, and all of us voted one way or the other, Motor Voter, and we now know from testimony here that this is still an experiment till 2018, general election of 2018, and then we'll have a good idea of how much the registration turned into voter participation. Why would we not, or is there a need, if we so intended to, why would we not hold everybody harmless until after the November 18 election, when we know what it is, the impact of what we did? Does it make sense? My question makes sense to you? You understand what I'm asking?
I understand what you're saying.
Right.
I do. And the legislature could do that. You could make that policy choice now if you wanted to. I think that is it would probably be a more complicated discussion than just fixing the typo in the bill. I think you could always kind of, you hit the pause button. The intent was you hit the pause button for one election, because that was the first election after Motor Voter, and nobody quite knew what the effect was going to be. So you pause it for one election, wait and see what happens, and then if you need to make adjustments, you can do it in 2017 or thereafter. That was the idea, and all we're trying to do is fix this typo to get that back in place. So that's all we're trying to do. Now, if what you want to do is say, well, when we hit the pause button, we really should pause it for two election cycles, that's a policy choice. We could do it, but we really are, I'm pleading now, I know that, we just want to fix this typo to avoid this immediate harm to these two parties, because that's the immediate harm.
But back to what the bill does, if you were a minor party and you qualified under 4B, Motor Voter didn't change anything. You still qualify based on those 2014 election 4B, turnout numbers.
That's right. So you're right. So the small minor parties who are going to be okay under 4B, they're going to be okay in 2016, okay in 2018. It's actually the bigger minor parties, the Libertarian and Working Families parties, they get a respite for 2016. The pause button is in effect in 2016. But in 2018, we do the calculation again based on the higher registrations. So, you know, okay, for them...
He's explained two different things here, so I'm confused again. Madam Chair. Okay, so the two parties, you cannot switch back and forth between the two. What I'm looking at is if it's the two major minor parties, boy, this is getting complex here, the two larger minor parties, right? Basically, the small parties are held harmless the way it is through 2018, and then it comes out, and it goes on. It's the two larger minor parties that, of course, could be at risk, what we're saying here, and you're pleading. I get you're pleading, but you know how well that works with me. Okay, it's those two parties that could, in fact, because of there's voter registration that may or may not participate and may never have intended to participate, but we said, here's your opportunity, they may be impacted. And the question then is, what point, if you didn't fix that now and said, hey, we recognize there may be a negative impact, unintended consequences, technical fix, technical short session, would we then come back in February of 20, in your mind, come back in February of 17 and say, okay, it does look like this is going to have a seriously negative impact that was unintended on these two, and we should move the calendar down the road one election. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Fix this immediate problem for the 2016 election and come back in 2017 and reassess. And you can always hit the pause button again for the next election in 2018.
But for the record, Madam Chair, what I think I'm hearing, correct, Deputy Secretary of State, is that you recognize there may, and we don't know, but there may be a problem of that nature that has to be fixed or should at least be addressed in the next session.
That should be looked at, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any other questions? Senator Farioli?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I really appreciate seeing a bill before the committee that is attempting to correct a drafting error, which is what the intention of the special session or the short session is. Not minimum wage, not tax measures, not sweeping policy. So please convey to the secretary that I appreciate and all the staff something in keeping with the purpose of the short 35-day legislative session. That being said, I have a couple of letters that have arrived. I think there are these on all lists. They've been posted in opposition from two of the minor parties, explaining that this sets up a situation that treats three of the minor parties in one way and two of the minor parties in another way. Now, I heard your testimony say that your interpretation of the legislative intent was that we intended to provide a safe harbor for all the minor parties for a full cycle. If we make the changes that are proposed, we have left two of the minor parties without that safe harbor, at least according to my understanding of the two letters. And Madam Chair, a follow-up. Have you seen the letters?
We have seen the letters.
Okay, so these two parties are opposed to this fix because it leaves them out. Please address that issue.
So there was a letter from Mr. Peralta, and Mr. Peralta's made the point, the good point, which was the intent was to create a safe harbor for one election cycle.
Right.
And his point was, if that was the point, if that was the intent, then it looks like you're providing a safe harbor for everybody under 4A, but you're not providing a safe harbor for anybody under 4B. So amend the bill, give a safe harbor for 4A and 4B, and the response to that is we don't need to correct 4B because those people are fine. They're going to be fine through the 2016 election. We only have to fix 4A because it's that calculation that happens in 2016. Well,
Madam Chair, if I can follow up.
Well, there's one other witness. Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Both of these correspondents are experts, far more than just astute. They are focused, driven, informed, educated professionals. And you're saying to them, trust me.
I'm saying.
And they're saying to you, we oppose the bill because it's flawed.
And I would say to them respectfully that they're incorrect, that Mr. Peralta's analysis there is incorrect because he's asking for a fix to 4B.
No, I understand what's being asked for.
Right.
Mr. Meek and Mr. Peralta, who are not casual participants, they are of expert status. They would be here today if they could be.
Right. Right.
Are in opposition to this bill because it fails to correct a flaw that they believe and that you've testified to was the legislative intent. I think it was our legislative intent. And your answer to them is, trust me, you don't need this fix.
I think that Mr. Peralta's objection is the parties that use 4B need the same safe harbor through 2016, and the response is the existing law provides them that safe harbor already. There's no change necessary. So that's the response to Mr. Peralta's.
Well, Madam Chair, if I can, these are the things that injunctions are made of. If there's a legal disagreement between the Secretary of State's interpretation and the folks that are legal representatives of the party, then that ought to be resolved before we proceed. If it's simply a disagreement, then it should be, Madam Chair, if I could, it should be reconciled before we take action on this bill. If it is a misinterpretation, we have access to the legislative council. I believe Mr. Meek is a council. I'm absolutely certain that the Independent Party of Oregon has legal counsel. I would suggest that we comport everybody's understanding because there is clearly a disagreement about what this bill will accomplish. I will not look favorably on a bill that turns out, despite our best intentions, I mean, we're here redrafting because we screwed it up. I will not accept somebody's assessment that it's not a problem, don't worry about it, you don't need this fix. Well, I have two really highly qualified elections participants who represent parties in Oregon saying they oppose the bill because it's got a fatal flaw in it. So, Madam Chair, I'm going to ask that we reconcile the understanding that this is not needed or that we fix it if it is needed. And that's not going to occur until we have parties, I think, who are at the table having a discussion and come to a conclusion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Farrioli, just to reassure you, we're just in a public hearing today. We will be taking this bill up in a work session next week. I'm not sure that we would ever be able to get a meeting of the minds on everybody on this, but because it's clear that there was simply the wrong section of the statute was put in the bill. Legislative Council is here in the room to reiterate that if need be. But I think if people want more time to talk to people who didn't show up today, there certainly will be time to do that between now and next week.
And
we
sure
do have an additional witness signed
I
up.
I do appreciate that. There will be a little bit of time to try and reconcile this because, you know, I'd hate to find out down the road that we were convinced that the changes weren't necessary and find out, in fact, they are necessary and leave two of the minor parties, you know, out of the mix. That was not our intent.
It certainly wasn't our intent. It's not what the bill does either. And then just two other quick things. Mr. Meek's comment is it's different. I read it differently than Mr. Peralta's. I think Mr. Meek's comment is for those who use 4B, eventually down the road in 2018, 2020, these later elections, they might get affected because of Oregon Motor Voter and increased participation. And that kind of goes to Senator Boquist's point about, well, how long should we keep pushing the pause button? Or should we extend the pause for through 2018 or 2020? And that's a conversation you can have in 2017. by all means have it in 2017, but the immediate harm happens to these minor parties that use 4A in 2016. And I would welcome the conversation with Mr. Meek and Mr. Peralta. I'm disappointed they aren't here. I was disappointed to get their comments this morning, given that this was an issue that was vetted in 2015 and a fix we were trying to get to. So I wish we had them in the room, and I would be happy to talk to them. The last thing I would offer, and I know he's here and we talked to him this morning, is your lawyer, your legislative counsel, that can confirm what I've just told you about what the state of the law is and what the need for the fix is. So he's here, he's ready, and if you want him, we can have him come up.
Any additional questions, Senator Farrelly,
for these witnesses? To move the process forward in view of the fact that we don't intend to go to work session, there's time to have those conversations, not in front of them.
Okay. Thank you. And Senator Boquist, another question.
And Madam Chair, I mean, I'm at the point where I think there's just a misunderstanding, but I think it is the responsibility of the Secretary of State's office to at least try and reach out to both of them and say, hey, I don't think you see this. We don't agree. This is what we're trying to do, because I think when you get through apples and oranges, everybody's talking about the fruit basket. The problem here is some people are still out in the vegetable garden. So I think a little communications with these two fairly significant leaders, considering one of them, council, does have enough money to cause a lot of problems, being on the campaign finance committee, I'm familiar with that. So I think just reaching out, if the Secretary of State could reach out to them and say, hey, this is not what we're intending, this is what it is, and I think it could probably resolve 90% of this issue.
Okay, thank you, Senator Boquist.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Devlin, I see you're in the room, and Representative Hoyle has just joined us, too. We have just one more witness on this bill. Are you okay for time? Okay, so we'll call her.
It means he's hiding.
And then we'll move on to the other bill. And so I'll call Kathy Hyatt on Senate Bill 1501.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Hyatt. I'm counsel for the Working Families Party, one of the minor parties affected by this bill. And what I'd like to do today is primarily to address the questions raised by Senator Boquist and Senator Farrelly about why the parties that are currently qualifying under 4A cannot switch to 4B, and why this bill does not, why the intent in 2015 was to do the effect as described by Mr. Taylor, and why this bill does not affect the minor parties qualifying under 4B or major parties.
And very briefly, we do have two legislators who are here on the next bill.
Understood, Chair. Thank you. And I don't know if I stated my name for the record. It's Kathy Hyatt, H-I-G-H-E-T, for Working Families Party. So first, with respect to Senator Boquist's question, the reason that parties currently qualifying under 4A cannot qualify under 4B is that 4B has two requirements. One is the lower registration threshold previously discussed. The second is to run a candidate statewide and get 1%. In order to qualify in 2016, you have to have run a candidate in 2014 or 2012. So if you didn't already run a candidate before Motor Voter was passed, it is too late to do so in time to qualify for 2016. So while the 4B parties, if they could register enough voters, would have the option of qualifying under 4A, the 4A parties have no way at this point to qualify under 4B. It's too late for them to run a candidate. The second question is, Senator Farrelly asked, how do we know that the intent is indeed as explained by Mr. Taylor? And the reason is you can look back at how the fix in 2015 came to be, and it's quite clear what the intent was. So in 2015, the first Motor Voter Bill was actually drafted in 2013. At that time, what is currently A was B, and what is currently B was A. And my apologies about that. So at that time, you had A, which talked about the number of people who voted in the governor's election, and B, which talked about registered voters. And the fix drafted in 2013 in the Motor Voter, the phase-in, as it were, pointed to B. It said the number of registered voters in B shall be considered such and such. That 2013 motor voter bill did not pass, but another bill did, making a number of changes to the relevant statute, and one of the changes it did was flip B and A. Then in 2015, the motor voter, the same motor voter bill or a similar one was passed, and it had the same fix, still pointing to B. But now it was pointing to B, talking about something that had been moved to A. So to anyone who traces out the bills and the statutes with some basic legal principles, it is entirely clear that the intent was to fix the language in A using the language. It's the same language between the two. And when it was originally drafted, it pointed to the subsection that had that language. So there's no doubt as to the intent. That's the first point. The second question you asked is, and I see the validity of, you don't want to give any party special treatment. I absolutely agree. This bill will not affect any parties other than those qualifying under what we now call A, the larger registration requirement. So first, with respect to major parties, those are a completely different statute. ORS 248.006, not .0008. So passing this bill will have absolutely no effect on 006. Yay or nay doesn't touch the major parties at all. The second is that passing this bill does not affect a party's ability to qualify under B. If the progressive party is that we would like a favor relating to B, and I think that they've got a good idea worthy of consideration, but passing this bill will not impair the ability of this committee to look at it in the short session, if they so choose, or in the long session. And they have until the legislature has until 2020 to address this issue, because the 2020 is the first election in which the motor voter bill can at all affect the ability of minor parties to qualify under B. So I would be happy to answer questions if the chair believes that there's time.
I have a very simple question.
Thank you for your testimony. Yes, Senator Boqvist.
would you say as written the bill is a yes or no?
I'm sorry, thank you. As written the bill is a yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Maybe you can help explain it to your peer parties. And
I'd be happy to engage with them. I don't know whether we can reach consensus or not.
Any other questions for Ms. Hyatt? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony, and I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1501 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1586, and I'll ask the sponsors to come forward and Erin to briefly explain the bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1586 directs public universities and community colleges to increase voter registration access and information, and the measure also requires the state to prepay for the postage of ballot return envelopes for each election held in Oregon. That provision would apply to elections held after January 1 of 2017. We did receive an amendment this afternoon from Senator Farioli that addresses a different section of the bill not referenced. It involves who can collect ballots, and the measure as the amendment would require each elector to return their own ballot unless it's collected or returned by a family member or a caregiver. The measure before you, Madam Chair, we have not received a revenue nor a fiscal impact, but it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means already attached.
Okay, thank you, Erin, for that explanation. And I see that we have two.
We get along really well.
I think we have two very experienced former Rules Committee chairs sponsoring this bill. So whichever one wishes to go first, go ahead.
Age before beauty.
No, I'll agree with that. Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, whenever I come back to this committee, it's actually like deja vu. I don't know if actually Representative Boyle, I think she'd recognize this, if I went to her committee, her former committee, it would be like deja vu also, because I spent two bienniums on the Rules Committee in the House also. I'm here to speak in favor of SB 1586, which would reduce barriers to the ballot and maintain Oregon's place as a leader in voter access. As a state, it's something to be proud of, that we've been on the forefront of elections issues for so many years. With vote by mail, motor voter, which I know wasn't always that popular when it passed, But I'm glad to see that this committee is looking at the underlying issues of the implications of its passage by the legislature. And just like I did so many years ago, when vote by mail was actually passed at the initiative process, we had to actually deal with it in the following session and its implementation. SB 1586 is a two-part bill. The first part would allow for paid postage on all ballots for all elections beginning in January 2017. This would be done through business reply envelopes, so only those ballots returned by mail would be charged to the state. You may ask the very simple question, why January 2017? The simple answer to that is to give time for the actual implementation. The reality is we've had a lot of contact with county clerks, with counties, with the Secretary of State, with other parties that would be impacted. And the reality is that many of our county clerks have purchased envelopes for all of the elections in this particular year we are in. So if we change the envelopes, they would have a lot of envelopes they wouldn't be able to use. And we just thought it might be better to give people more time to implement something that would be a fairly significant change. So this would apply actually in January 2017. So the first time would be in the March special election in 2017. The second part of SB 1586 would provide more opportunities for nonpartisan voter registration efforts on higher education campuses and ensure that ballot boxes are located within a reasonable distance of the main campus, not all satellites, but the main campus. All of us, I believe, both House and Senate members, Democrats, Republicans, and occasionally we've had an independent in this, believe that voting is a fundamental right. It is at the core of our democracy. Citizens should be able to have their voices heard. Barriers, to the extent that they can be taken away, should be removed. SB 1586 is a reasonable solution that makes it easier for Oregonians to cast their ballot and gain access also to information that would be helpful to inform them to vote. I would hope that you would support this measure. I understand, I've already seen that there is a pending amendment to the measure. We will probably have an amendment next week. We are resolving some technical issues, just trying to make this bill as perfect as we can before it actually leaves this committee, and then it will go on to Ways and Means. And I think, as Senator Farioli said, this is a very short session, and so we've tried to actually do a lot of work behind the scenes for actually the last several months, and like many of you here, and including my colleague to my left and to your right, a lot of the work hasn't been done by me. It's been done by the staff behind me and Representative Hoyle's staff also and other staff in the building. So we're just trying to make sure that we get you as perfect a bill by next week when you go into work session as we can.
Great. Thank you, Senator Devlin. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Val Hoyle, State Representative for House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. I want to thank you all for allowing us to testify on this bill. My colleague, Senator Devlin, really outlined some of the specifics of the bill. And as he said, we've been working on this for many months. And I believe we were both sponsors when this bill came forward in the last session as well. So this is not the first time that this is being heard. This has been heard before. This Senate Bill 1586, and I won't go over the things that Senator Devlin talked about, so I'll just keep my comments brief. Senate Bill 1586 allows for eliminating the need for stamps when voting by allowing for business reply envelopes. Also allows for ballot boxes to be located within reasonable distances of main higher education campuses. And the reason for this is to eliminate barriers to voting. And although having a stamp, it's a 49-cent cost, I don't believe that there should be a cost to voting. Also, when you have young people, when I go to my children and ask them, who are both of voting age, if they have a stamp, they look at me like I have three heads because they don't use the mail very often. So if we want to help people to reduce obstacles to voting, one thing that we can do is take away the need to have a stamp.
Students, low-income individuals, and others who do not keep stamps on hand will be positively impacted by the bill. Also, having ballot boxes on higher education campuses will reduce barriers to the ballot for students because they'll be able to have easy access to drop off their ballot. I believe this is a much-needed bill. I'm proud to be sponsoring it again. I'm very proud to be seated with my colleague, Senator Devlin, as we're both in support of this bill.
Great. Well, thank you both for your testimony and for bringing this bill forward. Do we have any questions for our colleagues?
I do.
Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ask the same question I asked the students that have visited my office today in discussion of this bill. I asked them, had they contacted the local elections officials in their community to ask if we needed a statute to require something of elections officials, which is their duty and their privilege and their pleasure to perform, which is increasing voter participation. Could we simply ask them to put a voter receptacle, a ballot receptacle, on college campuses? And so I'd like to ask if you inquired of the elections officials, if we could just ask them to do that, or if the community college members or the college campus members just simply ask them to do that, would they do it?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrioli, we have had discussions with the counties and both and the county clerks, and the discussion has been a very friendly discussion. And I don't want to state this in any way that it doesn't sound friendly. It appears now, after doing a great deal of examination of where these boxes are in association with the 17 community college campuses we have and the 7 university campuses, we will need 6 additional boxes. That's our current estimate to meet the requirements in the bill. I'm always a very transparent person, so I'll have to say we've already adjusted how far away from a campus one of these boxes could be in an amendment that you will see. So that gets it down to 6. The counties would like to be paid for those 6. We believe the cost is going to be approximately about $2,500 for the boxes, then plus the installation, and plus we believe there'll be the universities and the community colleges, I think, will be receptive to putting them on their land, so there'll be no purchase of land necessary. But I think the counties are asking that if we're expanding their need for drop-off boxes, that they be paid for it.
And Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Farrioli, the answer to your question would be yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Additional question?
Well, Madam Chair, follow up. The cost, in just a casual conversation, we were fortunate enough to have the county elections officials in Salem for the last couple of days, so I took the opportunity to ask them, and they felt that the total cost would be about $4,000 per location.
Yeah.
So I assume we're going to get a fiscal that gives us a little mechanism for analysis and a little better fix on the total cost.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrioli, yes, that's the case. I'm roughly estimating it at 5. We'll get a probably more defined fiscal, but I thought it would be in the $4,000 to $5,000 range.
Yeah. And just an observation, Madam Chair, I don't know. Those of us that have gone through the teenagers with our children seldom got any look except the one that was described by Representative Hoyle on any question that we asked him, you know, about the 3-head thing.
Yes.
but personally, I find the idea that, you know, the future leaders of our society don't have a stamp to be tragic. I mean, we've done everything we can to make exercising franchise easy, even though the purchase of that exercise costs blood. And folks are unable to exercise their franchise because they don't have a stamp. I mean, that's maybe it's a commentary on the advancement of our civilization, but I find it really hard to explain to people that folks don't vote because they can't find a stamp. We give them 3 weeks and they can't find a stamp. It just seems to me to be a sad commentary. The solution, Madam Chair, to put prepaid envelope indices on all envelopes, for all return envelopes, seems to be big hammer to solve a little bitty problem. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Rosenbaum and Vice Chair Farioli, thank you for the comment. What I would say is that things have changed in terms of how people communicate. We have email, we have internet, we have cell phones, there's texting. And so as the method of communication changes, I think we have to acknowledge how can we make things easier, like voting. And you are right. You are absolutely right. The right to vote was fought for and bled for. People died so that we could have the right to vote. And I believe that as a fundamental right, we should have no obstacles, not even a 49-cent poll tax. So if we can reduce barriers, why wouldn't we? Why wouldn't we? Because it's a very, very, very important thing. And I want to make sure that each person who is eligible to vote can do so with as few barriers as possible. And I know that the good senator feels the same way.
Madam Chair, if I could respond. I wish that Senator Winters could hear you refer to the cost of a stamp, a poll tax, because I think she would have some real interesting conversations with you about what it cost her grandfather to vote when he actually paid a poll tax. So the reference, I think that is not a good reference to make. A stamp is not a poll tax. People that paid a poll tax, there were a number of issues I don't need to tell you about. I think you are aware. This is not a poll tax, doesn't compare to a poll tax, and I think that that reference would be deeply insulting to the people who lived through that period or had their parents or grandparents live through that period.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, I'm sorry you found that offensive. I find it, I strongly, strongly feel that there should not be a cost to voting, even if it's 49 cents. Voting should be free. It should be free for someone to vote and to turn in their ballot. And that is why I'm supporting this bill now and why I supported it previously. But I do appreciate you sharing your perspective.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Duplin.
I understand the comments of my good colleague to my left, and I understand the comments from Vice Chair Senator Farioli. I just think the world has changed a lot, to be quite honest. I mean, I remember when we were implementing vote by mail, and some of you are around. Senator Farioli was around. You were around. Senator Burdick was around. That didn't count. Is one of the reasons we have such a long period. The 18 days that ballots were out was that literally there were places in the state that didn't have daily during weekday mail delivery. Actually, there are a lot of places in the state that now don't have daily weekday. So we're trying to adjust to changes that were being made in law. And I think in this particular regard, young people, actually seniors, and I'm getting to reflect that comment, seniors, don't actually get to the post office as much anymore. We send very little mail. I can still remember the days when, and probably all of you did this at one time, when monthly you'd get down and you'd write all the checks out and you would send out whatever it was, 8, 10, 12 different bills. I do that all now in about 3 minutes. And that's as long as it takes me. I rarely, if ever, send anything by mail, you know, from my home, other than if it's some physician's bill or hospital bill where there's a portion of it that's left due because I haven't put them on the banking system that I have because they're such a rare occurrence. And I just think taking down every barrier that you can is a good thing. And we've looked at this very carefully from a financial standpoint also. People have talked about putting postage on the return envelope. That's actually a more expensive version than the business reply. Because if you actually put postage, real postage, on all the envelopes, you're actually paying for all of those, even if they're never returned, even if they're dropped in a drop box. This, I think, will keep the cost within a reasonable level. I think actually it's something good to do. And if we can take on any barrier and get more participation in our process, that is a fundamentally good thing to do in a representative democracy.
Okay, thank you.
I do have one more question.
Okay, because we do have other questions down here, too.
If we do end up putting the indices on the return envelope at a better price, that certainly I do agree with, more efficiency, doesn't that turn every mailbox in Oregon into a receptacle? And aren't those post offices and receptacles on college campuses? Aren't they certainly within the radius that you've described? Is there no mail slot near college campuses where the prepaid envelope can be dropped? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Something to ponder.
Yes. Senator Farioli and I will have many discussions, Senator Farioli and Madam Chair.
No answer?
Oh, would you? Yes, if you would like, Madam Chair, if there's time. I think actually there is an element of truth in that. I think our hope is that we will still have a fairly good split between people that will drop off their ballots and people that will actually mail in their ballots. I think we've both seen changes in behavior in that over the years. And I think that for practical purposes, we think the split may remain about the same. So a lot of people will still, you know, this notice that the Secretary of State always sends out, if it's past Friday, don't mail your ballot. So I think we're still going to be in that same kind of scenario. So.
Thank you, Senator Farioli and Senator Boquist.
I'm just trying to figure technical questions here
for
the proposal. The first one I guess struggling with is that when I was a student body president, and I know there's some people back there saying, hey, that guy was actually a student member anyway, but we had a voter registration drive, so on and so forth. And a lot, frankly, what I see here are, there are some pretty good ideas here, we'll just say, but a lot of them are already, we're already doing them, and I'm not sure why we're formalizing, but that's okay. But the fundamental question I have is that it's the same one I had with the Secretary of State, and that comes back down to real honest to goodness student access. And if we're going to encourage and do all this stuff and go door-to-door and re-register everybody at the college, and we just did motor-by-voter to get them to re-register with their ID card, right, and we're going through that process, at some point these two are going to kind of, we're either going to be at saturation point or we're going to be consistently, the state's going to pay for them to do the motor voter when they re-register and then back to the student back and forth. So where is the saturation point? And if we're doing motor voter and all the students are getting registered that way, why are we going to do it door-to-door in the university? And I think the two of you do have an appreciation if you, both of us, all you could turn around and look behind you. When we were that age, we moved in and out of the dorms and we moved from apartment to apartment pretty fast too. You understand, I'm just trying to, where is the saturation point and do we really need to do one or the other? And is not what it appears you're doing is you're trying to formalize a lot of things that we're already doing except for six universities. And if you give me the list, I'll call the presidents, by the way.
Do you want to?
I think as a thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and Senator Boquist. As a fellow former student body president who spent a lot of time doing voter registration and getting out the vote, I think the saturation point is when every single possible eligible voter is registered and feels that their voice matters enough to want to engage in the process. And so I do think that with motor voter, we will be shifting from voter registration over to voter engagement and getting out the vote. And what I like about motor voter is that it is throughout the state, not just in university areas or community colleges. And so I think the saturation point is when the job's done.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I would concur with the comments of my colleague to the left. I think also this issue about saturation, I think as we are in our former lives, we're moving around campuses. I think actually students move a lot around campuses now and go from university to university. And one of the things that we have found in actually voter registration is the people that are most disadvantaged are young people, in a sense, because they move so much that they often fall off the voter registration. I think it's just an effort to encourage them, and I think that's what the students that are taking from their busy schedules and are actually out there just trying to do nonpartisan registration are simply trying to fulfill, you know, trying to get people to participate in our participatory representative democracy. But I wanted to comment, since you were both student body presidents, the only, when I was at my first university, I was a newspaper columnist and critic of the administration, so.
I had one of those, too. I cut their funding. No, I didn't. Madam Chair, I mean, I'm still at the observation, but, I mean, because Senator Devlin and I have actually gone toe-to-toe in campaigns before, and so I'm very familiar with at least a half a dozen universities here in the state, and I'm quite certain our colleague to your left, Senator Devlin, is very familiar with this, but there is already a very active voter registration program and a very active get out the vote on the university campuses in the state of Oregon right now. Very active. Yeah. In fact, you beat us once, okay? So.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Boquist, and thank you both for bringing this forward. I wanted to just make one additional comment. Obviously, I liked this bill, and I signed on as a sponsor. You might remember, particularly Senator Devlin, that the Senate actually passed many of the provisions that are in this bill. I believe it was in the 2013 session, toward the end of that session, in a bill, but that bill didn't make it all the way through. It didn't make it through the House, so I'm really glad to see this coming back. And then finally, even though I know this bill can't solve every problem, but because we're going to hear from the county shortly, one of the things that I think is also true in terms of barriers is folks that don't live in major metropolitan areas and the lack of drop sites. And this has been an ongoing concern of mine, is that for many, many people, you don't have to live that far from where we are, the place where you can drop your ballot is City Hall during the hours that they're open, and or mail it. And that really is for the real world that people live in, not just young people, but people who work and elderly people. That can be a real problem. You know, it's a problem if you live in Scappoose. It's a problem all over the state, and I would guess probably in rural areas too. So hopefully, since I know you both have a strong interest in our voting and elections process, that's something we can work on too. But I agree that having prepaid, or not prepaid, but whatever the correct term is, would help a lot. So
well, thank Chair you for Rosenbaum, bringing this forward. Thank you so much for your support and for pointing out the nature of a bicameral legislature.
Okay, thank you both for your testimony. And we have four additional witnesses, and we only have three chairs, but I think I'll call them all four, and one of you can wait in the front row. And they are Rob Bovet, Danita Harris, Tabitha Pitzer, and Jesse O'Brien. And Rob, since you're here representing the county clerks, would you like to kick it off?
Sure.
Those are the six places.
Right. There you go.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I also represent the Oregon Association of County Clerks. First, I want to thank the sponsors, particularly Senator Devlin and his staff, for reaching out to me, well, many months ago, so I could engage the clerks on this concept so we could work out as many issues in advance as possible. There still are a number of remaining issues in the primary bill. I just got some Dash 1 amendments that I forward to the clerks for their review. Happy to send Senator Farioli's as well and any others. So hopefully by next week when you have a work session on it, if you want to hear back from me, I can report to you that the clerks are either got all their issues worked out or if we have anything left to still work out. More here to answer any questions you might have. If you make me identify the six, I'm going to have a real tough time with that. I just spoke with the clerks yesterday, but I have a very short memory. I can remember a couple of the community colleges off the top of my head, but I can't name all six at the moment.
Okay. Why don't we hear from the whole panel, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. And since I know we're nearing the end of the time of the committee, I'll be extremely brief. I think the merits of the bill have already been discussed at pretty great length, but OSPIRG strongly supports this bill. We think it'll strengthen Oregon's democracy, build off of the critical civic engagement role of Oregon's public institutions of higher education, and we think the benefits in terms of added convenience and participation of making vote by mail free for the voter well outweigh the real but modest cost to the state. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Hello, Chair Rosenbaum and Vice Chair Barry Woolley, and of course, members of the committee. My name is Tabitha Pitzer, and I'm a second year student at Oregon State University. And I'm here with the Oregon Student Association to urge you to support Senate Bill 1586. So, as we briefly mentioned, Senate Bill 1586 directs public universities and community colleges to increase voter registration access and information through instructed collaboration with campus student governments or student government equivalents. This bill also calls for ballot drop-off sites to be closer and more accessible to college campuses. And lastly, it modernizes the vote-by-mail system so that all ballots can be returned for free by business reply mail for each election held in this state. So not only am I a student at OSU, but I also work for the student government, ASOSU, as the Executive Director of Government Relations. So my job is essentially to ensure that students are politically aware and politically engaged. During my time serving students in this position, the amount of barriers we have faced to access students is really discouraging. Every year, our organization struggles to reach students in university housing, student orientations, and beginning of the year activities. We currently face restricted access to some of these locations or events, and we don't always have university support to access these places. We are always competing with other departments or organizations to engage students, and this severely impacts our ability to do our work. So for example, every year at OSU, we have a new student picnic where first-year students have the opportunity to engage with student organizations on campus and to learn about the organizations and other services that are provided to them. So ASOSU tables at this event every year, and we educate students about our organization, and we register them to vote. But this year was different. This year, the university gave the new student picnic to the athletics department, and the athletics department decided that no other organization was able to table at the event, and ASOSU was no exception to this rule. So due to restricted access to participate in this university event, we lost a wonderful opportunity to politically engage our first-year students. So we need help to ensure that we are able to access our constituents. We need help to ensure that we are able to target students where they are most likely to get involved, whether it be on campus or in the classroom. We need help to ensure that voter registration, education, and ballot drop-off is as accessible as possible. Students are busy. We work, we go to school, we have homework, we're engaged in our community, we have families, we struggle to find time to sleep, and we struggle to find time to be politically engaged. The current barriers we face only make political engagement more difficult, and increasing accessibility is sure to ensuring that students and those who live near college campuses have a voice in our state. Senate Bill 1586 ensures that young Oregonians have every opportunity to fulfill their civic duty and become engaged citizens by requiring access to students, close ballot drop-off sites, and a completely free voting process. This bill shows that Oregon values every Oregonian's voice in our democracy. And this is why I support Senate Bill 1586 and encourage this committee to pass it. Please remember my story when voting on this bill, and thank you for your speech today. I know it's kind of fast. I know we're on a time limit, so apologies.
Thank you for your testimony, and please go ahead.
Hello, Madam Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Ferrioli. My name is Danita Harris. I am a senior at Western Oregon University. I'll be heading to OSU for my master's program in September. I am here to urge you to support Senate Bill 1586. I will spare you all the details of the bill because it sounds like you're all very well versed in that. So I'm going to jump right into it. This bill removes significant barriers to civic engagement on university and community college campuses as it provides access to ballot drop-offs. For the voting population and the population that's around the college campus, so not just the students, but the community that's around that area as well, as public college campuses are community hubs and areas that are utilized by everyone. As such, these boxes are not only available for students, but also for community members. And many Oregonians, both rural and urban, experience transportation barriers that prevent successfully turning in a ballot. This bill offers an opportunity to lessen that burden. Having ballot boxes readily available to the student body also provides an educational experience for students who otherwise may not know how to turn in their ballot. Ensuring that post-graduation, these students will be able to be civically engaged and more responsible, active citizens within the community. Voting is the foundational cornerstone of our democratic structure. Civic engagement is vital to the well-being of a diverse democracy, especially one that prides itself on representing the community it is charged with serving. Alleviating barriers to participation in the democratic process will only secure the health of our communities in the future. Thank you for listening to me, and I urge you to support Senate Bill 1586.
Great. Well, thank you all for your testimony. Do we have any questions for this panel?
I just have a quick
Senator Boquist?
Rob, how are the clerks going to get paid for the water board election?
For the
mail. The bill says every election is going to be paid for by the state. So you do it. Special elections called for the water board in March, and Polk County clerk has to do it. How is she going to get paid, and how are we going to budget for it?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, the bill as it's being amended would basically provide for the state to pay for the costs of all of those return envelopes for the two primary elections, so as I understand it. So I don't think we'll have to pay if the state pays directly. So essentially, as I understand the mechanics of it, the United States Postal Service will send a bill to the Secretary of State for the full costs of all of the permits that get returned through the mail service, and the state pays the bill. We're not even going to act as the intermediary, which is the way we want it structured.
Well, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So, Rob, if I understand correctly, every election, every special election, every primary, every general, the clerks would just, you know, carry on business as usual. Good for you guys. I'm liking this better all the time as long as I'm not a legislator. Because the clerks want a lot of complaints. And then the state's just going to somehow budget and figure out how to do this.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, is
that your understanding of it?
It's my understanding that we're targeting, as I understand it, primary and general elections.
Only.
I believe. If the state wants to expand that, and I guess this has to be worked out in amendments, if at all, if the state wants to expand that to the March, we only have four elections left. We have primary, general, we have March and September.
Right.
And so if the state wants to cover them all, the clerks are certainly not opposed to having prepaid business reply mail on every single envelope, as long as the bill goes directly to the Secretary of State and the Secretary of State pays the bill.
As it is right now, mm-hmm. That's how the bill is written.
Yes.
And as you probably noticed, the bill also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means to figure all that out.
Yeah.
As far as fiscal.
Yes, and so, Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, we have our own fiscal concerns, but they're not that one.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, so I don't see any more questions for you, so thank you very much for your testimony. I did miss one more witness, and I'll call her forward, and then we'll be done. And that is Nikki Fisher, if you'd like to come forward.
Well, Madam Chair, where she's coming forward, when we used to go to the polls, it was free, too.
That's true, especially if you could walk there.
I think most universities, you could walk to the polls, right?
On campus, right. Hi.
Hi, Madam Chair. Hi, members of the committee. My name is Nikki Fisher. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Bus Project. As many of you know, the Oregon Bus Project is Oregon's leading organization focused completely on millennial outreach, voter engagement, voter education, and building strong and impactful leadership development programs for our future leaders. Our unique advocacy is organized by young people for young people. We're pretty quirky about that. We try to amplify the voice of the millennial generation. We're organized and focused on engaging young people in the democratic process. The Bus Project knows that our democracy is at its healthiest and most robust when citizens can vote and participate. We just want to consider this. Many of us don't have stamps. We just don't use them anymore. We don't mail resumes. We don't pay our bills online. We pay our tuition and our student debt online.
We don't compile our year-end taxes. I just filed my taxes. I did it all online. Mail is simply something that millennials often don't use. According to the United States Postal Service report, the UPS has basically drastically dropped by 56.3 billion units in the past 10 years. So Americans are mailing fewer and less packages. We believe that requiring a stamp to mail your ballot is a true barrier, and we worry not having a stamp to dissuade voters from participating in elections. We know that a stamp costs 49 cents, but if you know, many post offices are only open from 9 to 5 p.m., so young people who go to school, who work a job, aren't able to purchase that stamp. I went to the grocery store and asked if I could buy a single stamp, and they said I would have to purchase a book. A book of stamps just went up this year to $9.80. We know that in Lynn Benton Community College, the closest Dropbox location is 9.9 miles from campus. And Umpqua Community College in Roseburg, the closest Dropbox location is 7.7 miles. In places like John Day, we know that the post office is only open from 9 to 5. And so we need to make sure that young people are able to access that. It puts another additional barrier on individuals when people aren't able to go and purchase that stamp. So with that today, we believe that the state of Oregon can make a real difference in voter participation by removing the barriers. So we just wanted to say thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Did we have any questions? And congratulations on having filed your taxes. Now we all feel really like we're behind.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that completes our sign-up sheet on this bill. So I gather that we do have amendments already in our possession and some more on the way. So we will be taking this up at a future time. And I'll close the public hearing. And members, just to remind you that at our next hearing, which is Tuesday, of people who will be here in the room and on the phone to be confirmed, and that's what we'll do at our next hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your patience. And with nothing further today, we're adjourned.